Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this episode of City Talks. Today, my guest is Tom Kemeny, and Tom is a co-author of a book that was released a while back called The Rise and Fall of Urban Economies, Lessons from San Francisco and Los Angeles. So welcome to this episode of City Talks, Tom.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
And the book really is an attempt to try to think about the rise and fall of urban economies in a broader sense, and then using two particular places to try and get under the skin of some of those issues and really try to explain why we see some places do quite differently over a time period. So just tell us a little bit more about, you know, the book and what you're trying to do, and then we'll get into some of the detail.
Great. Sounds good, Andrew. So I think that was a good sort of entry into what we're trying to do in the book. All of us as scholars are interested in understanding the determinants of economic development in cities. And this book, while it's a study of two particular cities, is an attempt to grapple more deeply with theory and measurement, how we think about how cities develop, how we try and measure how cities are developing, and how we understand and measure the deep drivers, the causes of differences in development trajectories. And the way that I can paint the initial motivation for this study is by thinking about the changes in per capita income that we can observe in these two regional economies. And just to be clear about what I mean by regional economies, by San Francisco or the Bay Area, I mean a 10 or 11 county economic region. So this is really, Greater London as a sort of an equivalent. Mm-hmm. So I'm not talking about the city of San Francisco as sort of iconic as it might be. This is a regional economy that includes all of Silicon Valley. It includes, of course, the city of San Francisco, Oakland, and so on. So it's a large region with a population right now of about, I think, just under 8 million people. Mm-hmm. And then by Los Angeles, I'm talking about a five-county region that includes the county of Los Angeles, but also Orange County, Ventura, Riverside, and San Bernardino, with a population of, the last time I looked, roughly 18 million. Yeah. So these are very large metropolitan regions.
And the book takes a time period from 1970 and tries to plot change over time up until, you know, the recent current. I think mm-hmm. So it's interesting to get your thoughts on, you know, that's what that sort of perspective allows us to think about.
Yes.
And also, I think definitely what struck me in reading the book, and others undoubtedly will read it, is it's multidisciplinary. Mm. There's clearly an attempt to understand urban economic change, but the tools that you're using to understand that change are, you know, span more than economics and actually go into sociology and institutional literature as well. So say something about, you know, the time period and actually, you know, the tools that you're using to try and get under the skin of this.
Yeah, so the time period is very important. And so when I talk about this sort of this change in per capita incomes, when you look at it in 1970, which is the start date of our study, San Francisco and LA had very, very similar levels of per capita income. And then as we shift towards the present, they start to really strongly diverge from each other. And so this is really at the heart of the book, is trying to understand the drivers of this divergence, why the Bay Area did so spectacularly well relative to Los Angeles, and why Los Angeles did less well. And it's not just that the Bay Area did spectacularly well, which it certainly did compared to really any other city in the U.S. and perhaps in the world, but Los Angeles really has done significantly less well as compared to all of the other large metropolitan areas that it might have been compared to in 1970. So they're very similar to each other in 1970. They are very, very different today, with the Bay Area doing really at the top of the heap in the U.S. And Los Angeles doing much, much less well than San Francisco, but also less well than New York, less well than Boston, Washington, D.C., the list goes on and on. And so in terms of theories that we bring to bear, we're trying to understand this mystery, and there are a variety of theoretical tools or resources that we might use to try and answer this this question or this mystery. And these tools come from a broad range of disciplines, as you highlight. So there's sort of a variety of tools that come from economics. And so this I would describe as urban economics on the one hand and international and development economics on the other. And there are from sociology, there are tools that are focused more on institutions and organizations and how these evolve and how this matters for economic development. And then there are also sort of a hybrid of geography and economics, sensibly called the new economic geography, that helps us understand the evolution of specialization patterns and changes in cities across time. And so each of these, we felt, offer valuable but partial insights into this deeper question of development.
Yeah.
And development is this very sort of noisy social science problem. It's very complicated. It brings together people, firms, organizations, and so on, and territory and space. And so we, you know, each individual theoretical lens gives us some sort of insight, but not really sufficient to solve the mystery, as it were. And so we tried to span all of them.
And I think, I mean, I think one of the frustrations that comes through in the book, in some respects, I don't know if this was your reflections on it, was the slight frustration in that much of our thinking is pretty good at explaining a process or once it's underway, but actually not so good at trying to get at the root causes of why that process happens in the first place. And you unpick a little bit about this, in some regards thinking about the interactions between workers and jobs. And often we hear, you know, it's all about getting, being attractive to workers, and sometimes, you know, others would say, well, no, it's all about the jobs, and trying to reconcile and unpick some of that sort of stuff.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, so it flows very, very neatly from the theoretical setup that we have all of these accounts of what makes development happen. And in each of these accounts, whether it's conventional urban economics or development economics, they have a sort of a laundry list, or in more sophisticated senses, a kind of a mechanism through which development is conducted. And through that, you can identify, well, you know, according to this particular theory, the most important thing is low land use regulation, or according to another sort of theoretical setup, let's say development economics, the most crucial thing is to have high quality stocks of human capital, highly educated workers, for instance. But in all of these, it is very, very difficult to establish a clear sort of causal mechanism that allows us to say, if we, you know, push on this lever, this thing will happen. And looked at retrospectively, in the case of, you know, studying the evolution of these two regional economies, it is exceedingly difficult to try and weed through this kind of laundry list of important things to identify a causal sequence, a sort of, you know, to be able to say this is the ultimate, the deep determinant of why the Bay Area did so much better than LA, and more broadly, why one particular region outperforms another outside of these two particular
cases. Presumably, I suppose, because both of them are in California, then in some regards we can discount some of the state level or the macro level considerations about these two places are in different, you know, regulatory environments. They have a different tax base, a different immigration system, but actually, you know, by and large, they're operating in the same place. And interestingly, you know, picking up, they actually have probably very similar climates as well, which has often been expressed, or sometimes expressed, as being a key factor. But that explains probably the difference between places that have quite different climates, but obviously LA and San Francisco have broadly similar climates.
Yes. And so there was that element of case selection, of saying that the pairing of two places, two large metropolitan areas with the same sort of weather kinds of amenities, certainly, and a broad sort of common state infrastructure, and similar sort of geographical positioning. Both of them are large places with vibrant cultural communities, a great deal of sort of those sorts of quality of life factors that people value. So this is a way of sort of netting out some of those potential causes of the difference in economic performance. And then there's a whole series of other ones that we chase down. And this is really the core of the book, is to say, look, we've got these different theories. These theories tell us to look in these particular places. Let's go down the list and chase down each of these leads in the service of trying to figure out, well, you know, what is the bottom line? What is the key factor that drove this divergence. And so we spend a lot of time talking about specialization, yeah. which is an important focus both in the new economic geography and also in development economics, development economics rather. That's basically just about saying, look, what an economy does, what it's focused on, is going to be a direct driver of the kinds of productivity and consequently the wages that workers have in a particular location. So was there something about specialization that played a deterministic role in the evolution of these two regional economies? And similarly, was it something about the stocks of human capital? Of course, the Bay Area is sort of famous for having for growing, but also attracting very, very high skill workers. Yes. Is that the sort of the key? Is it about land use regulation that shut out poorer people from the Bay Area by limiting development? Was it about deliberate actions of policymakers in the Bay Area that produced good things and consequently either bad policies in LA or a lack of policies in LA? And so we're trying to chase down each of these leads to figure out where the real story is.
So take us, I mean, I think people, even if they're not familiar with many US cities, for example, I think they'll be familiar with the two that you've highlighted in San Francisco and obviously Los Angeles for a whole bunch of different reasons. But take us back to 1970 and paint a picture of what those two cities were like at that time, and then how they began to evolve. And you know a little bit about why you saw the trajectories that you did, why San Francisco clearly opened up quite a noticeable gap between it and Los Angeles.
Yeah, so I mean, they're an interesting pairing of cities in the sense that the Bay Area, and especially San Francisco, the city of San Francisco and the immediate environs, was the sort of a bastion of East Coast elites who moved to the West. And it was really the place in the West where there was, you know, culture with a capital C, ideas and so on. And in the early 20th century, it was a site of experimentation around radio, all of which and other kinds of what we might think of as proto high tech kind of stuff. In 1970, there was a mix of different things in the Bay Area. Silicon Valley was sort of emerging a little bit, although there wasn't really a whole lot. Certainly not the kind of consciousness of being a focus on high tech that there might be even a decade later. But there was a mix of industries serving the Defense Department. So this is outgrowths of this radio industry. There is a whole bunch of farming going on, right? There's apricots and plums and peaches and things like that in what would become Silicon Valley proper, and honestly not that much else in 1970. And there was certainly high-tech activity, but it was relatively nascent.
Yeah.
And there was heavy industry in many other parts, let's say in Oakland and Alameda County and so on. And so it was sort of a mixed economy with a variety of different things, but not very sort of sharply specialized in any one activity.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, of course, we have the movie industry, which Indeed. Is, for what it's perhaps most famous for, which had come out of a crisis in around 1950 with the rise of television and also a decision by the government that forced the splitting of distribution and movie making and led to a reshuffling of Hollywood towards a more sort of project-based, much more flexible, what we think of today as kind of almost a cluster.
Yeah.
But in a stage before that idea was really a one that was fashionable in economic development circles. Yeah. And then there was a very, very large aerospace industry that grew out of entrepreneurs and tinkerers around the turn of the 20th century and in the first, let's say, 30 years of the 20th century, that grew into this enormous, mostly government-serving, Department of Defense-serving industry, building aircraft, but also in 1970, building a great deal of very, very high-tech stuff. LA in, I think, the early 1960s is the largest producer of semiconductors in the United States. And the major client, almost the singular client, really, is the US government. And so it's doing large-scale manufacturing, especially oriented towards this sort of aerospace kind of activity.
And so in 1970, if you were there and someone said to you, You have these two cities. Which one do you think over the next 30 years is going to be more successful? And we would the reasonable person have gone for Los Angeles or not?
I'm not sure that there is a sort of a reasonable person one way or the other, in the sense that both of them had their merits. It's what I will say is that there is no one in 1970 could clearly point to the Bay Area as being an obvious winner the way that in retrospect it so clearly is.
Yeah.
Right? At that moment in time, and so this kind of touches on an earlier point about why we're looking at such long time horizons and why we've drawn the line around 1970.
Yeah.
There's a reason why 1970 is a good place to start, because we can think of it as a kind of a shoulder between the old economy and the new economy. And I think a big part of the focus of this book and the long duration, which I can tell you posed enormous analytical challenges, because finding good data about things that are happening in the 1970s is not an easy thing to do. Absolutely.
No.
But what's so important about it is we talk in development circles about evolution and about related variety and sort of having pieces that allow you to shift from one thing to another. And this is a very dominant conversation among people studying development in cities.
Yeah.
But I think what that conversation misses is that that makes sense in the context of one sort of larger set of arrangements that coheres at a particular time. But there are moments in which the rules of the game radically switch.
Right.
And 1970, you know, give or take, is a sort of this point at which something new is happening in the global economy that involves a major reshuffling of the geography of the economy as well, as these sorts of shifts do. This is not the only sort of shift that we can describe in the last couple of hundred years of capitalism. But we can see that each of these sort of major shifts from one sort of set of economic arrangements to another implies a shift in geography.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1970, you would still be thinking about an old economy in which success was determined on the basis mostly of high technology, but at scale.
At scale, yeah.
Right? And so along with social arrangements and work arrangements and unions and, you know, a whole sort of assemblage of institutions that fit with that particular mode of production. But on the other hand, you know, in 1970, there was this shift happening and this new thing emerging and this new thing that now we all recognize as sort of the basic way that capitalism is now organized.
Yeah.
That wasn't obvious then. And consequently, the Bay Area, which was kind of ahead of the game, which was one of the winners of this shift as a place, it wasn't obvious that the things that we now recognize as virtues and sort of unique features of the Bay Area that we all in other cities want to emulate, and London is no different, and other cities in the UK are no different, it wasn't obvious that those would really be virtues and that those would be sort of central pillars for how capitalism works.
Because I think that's one of the interesting things around, when you look retrospectively, sometimes we could say, oh yes, you can perfectly plot out the history and therefore everything seems to make sense. But actually, as you say, when you're in the moment, actually you're faced with two choices or three choices. Mm. The one that you make may or may not be, in hindsight, you know, when you look forward or look backwards, maybe the right one. But obviously there's two other choices or three other choices you don't make. And I think that's is an interesting perspective, the way you talk about LA's evolution in that regard. And, you know, for example, the power that those interests in and around the port had, and obviously an attempt through economic shocks, much of which coming from outside the region, were having on the manufacturing and the aerospace industry and how they fought to resist that in some respect. But,
yeah, I mean, so there's this idea that we talk about in the book, which has to do with a vision of what the economy, what the economy is and how it should evolve. And I want to be cautious about ascribing too much agency in the sense that we don't argue in the book that there are particular groups or elites that sort of push buttons and make things happen in economies. Economies are enormously complex. All of them, no matter how successful or unsuccessful, have all sorts of constituencies that are butting heads with each other and sometimes having conversations that work and other times not. And so there's no sort of magic hand that's coordinating things. But one of the points that we make when we, in the book, one of the ways that we try and understand what has happened in these two places is to look at the conversations that regional elites had in both of these two places, undertaking a very, very comprehensive content analysis of the, what they've talked about in their reports over many decades. And what you do see in the Bay Area is that there was a much clearer awareness and a greater sort of singular focus or consensus, we might say, around how the Bay Area can be a sort of a leader and an economically vibrant place. And that has to do with this sort of bringing together of different groups around a culture of experimentation and high technology. And when you contrast that with the conversation in LA, which is much more mixed up around what to do with the decline in manufacturing, which is a problem that regions around the world, and certainly around the developed world, in the 70s and 80s were really, really struggling with. That the basis for comparative advantage that worked in the old system, in the old economy, was no longer working. And in fact, this happened in the Bay Area as well. The Bay Area also had a fair amount of heavy and light manufacturing, and much of that went away, as it did in Los Angeles, as it did in many cities around the world.
Yeah.
But there's the question of how elites imagined what their economy should be. And in LA, it was very, very backwards looking. It was focused on how can we get that back? How can we bring it back? And there were reasons why that's a very sensible idea, in the sense that, of course, heavy manufacturing in LA, as in many other places, supported the employment of a great number of workers at varying levels of skill, but not only, you know, college educated, high sophistication kind of work, but other sort of somewhat more routine manufacturing jobs, a sort of a broad based employment sector, and that was going away. And so there, of course, there's a desire to figure out how can we make sure that these workers that we have continue to have are able to sustain themselves. And among other things, that led to a kind of a focus to think about how to redevelop the port and how to make sure that the port was a continuing in the sort of broader logistics sector was a continuing and an important part of Los Angeles's economic development strategy. The problem with this, of course, is that those kinds of jobs are generally medium and low wage. So they are large numbers of jobs, but they're not necessarily high-quality jobs. And I think this is a problem a lot of the time in discussions about economic development, especially with policymakers, where there's a focus on, well, how many jobs can we generate, rather than focusing on producing not, of course, we want many jobs, but they need to be high-quality jobs, especially if we're focused on what we call in the book as sort of a high-road development strategy.
And as an aside, just in the book, you talk a little bit about obviously Hollywood and the entertainment industry being super concentrated in LA, and people will be familiar with that. But actually, its overall effect on the regional economy of Los Angeles is not that great. I mean, but nevertheless, it seems to get a lot of attention from policymakers or from from boosterists. Is that fair or is that right?
Well, and they're not wrong to focus on the entertainment industry, in the sense that if you look at Los Angeles's evolving specialization, what it does, and especially what it does that serves the rest of the world rather than dry cleaners and barbershops. The motion picture industry, broadly conceived, and the entertainment industry employs a very large number of people. But if you look at the specialization of the Bay Area and Los Angeles in the last 10 or 15 years, one of the things that's striking is the Bay Area is very, very specialized in relative terms, by which I mean a very large percentage of its workforce is focused in IT and related kinds of activities. By contrast, in LA, there is no particular industry that's anywhere close, not even half or maybe even not even a third, as focused on anything as people in the Bay Area are focused on IT. And that's not to say that it would necessarily be desirable for LA to be more specialized in something. What matters is that you're specialized in the right kinds of things, not just that you're specialized
in something.
But the motion picture industry does emerge as, I think, number two or so among these sort of tradable, right, meaning serving the broader world rather than just the regional economy. Among those industries that are serving the broader world, the motion picture industry is a big one. And, of course, it's a huge part of the region's identity, and it does generate very large amounts of money. It generates a good number of high-quality jobs. It generates enormous amounts of revenue and profits for the region. So it's not like it's not warranted. What we observe in terms of its relationship to the rest of the regional economy is that it is much more disconnected. If we think of motion picture as sort of the big bright light in the Los Angeles region, it's not the only one, but it's certainly an important one. It is much less connected to the rest of the economy than IT is in the Bay Area. And partly that's just a function of its relative size, right? It's much less relatively important than IT in the Bay Area. But there's something else there as well, which is that it just isn't connected. And this is partly the story of the region more broadly, that LA, you can think of the economy as much more sort of balkanized in terms of the networks among industries, among firms, among agents, among individuals. The sort of the pathways for disseminating ideas are much more fragmented. And as a consequence, even if there are ideas that come from Hollywood that could somehow be part of a resurgence in LA, they're sort of cut off. They're in their own little bubble. And we don't see that sort of balkanization in the Bay Area. And it's one of the reasons we think why the Bay Area has been so good at overcoming crises.
Yeah. And connecting the specific of the two to the, you know, to the broader our broader thinking around, you know, urban economies and why they perform in the way that they do. You do place quite a significant store and importance on this idea of, or the notions of associated with specialization. Just say a little bit about why that does emerge from the, you know, the all the investigations as being a factor that really helps us understand the performance places, but actually we'll come onto this, I think, a little bit later, begins to tell us a little bit about how we might want to respond if we want to see more places, you know, do better than they currently are. So why specialization? What does it, what's it doing for places?
Right. So specialization is quite simply what an economy does. And specialization is important in the most sort of superficial sense because, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, a particular set of activities has a related level of productivity, and that's going to shape wages. So what an economy does shapes how rich it is. But that's not really sufficient to understand how specialization played a role in these two economies and more broadly why specialization matters. So one of the things we try and chase down, there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem when you talk about specialization and the sort of the quality of the labor force. So there's a lot of emphasis these days in economic development circles on attracting the right kinds of workers, right? Whether we talk about the sort of Richard Florida style of things or a sort of Ed Glaser style, either way, there's this emphasis saying if we draw the right sort of workers, meaning highly educated workers, and then maybe there are other characteristics that matter as well, then magically good things are going to happen. When we look at these two regional economies, what's clear is that, first of all, in the early days of our study, both regions are very well endowed with high quality workers as we might measure them. And the tools to measure them are imperfect. They're mostly about the number of years of schooling or other sorts of features of their schooling. But when you look at these two regions on that basis, they both have lots of well-educated workers in roughly similar proportions. And even when we look at, let's say, you know, the share of workers with PhDs or that kind of thing, right? So they're both highly educated workers. What we see that supports an emphasis on specialization is that, and I mean an emphasis on specialization as opposed to an emphasis on human capital as an independent driving force, is that as we move through time, workers who have similar levels of education are much more highly rewarded in the Bay Area, right? So if you're a college-educated worker or if you hold a master's degree and you're working in LA and you're working in the Bay Area, you're going to earn a lot more in the Bay Area Bay Area than you are in LA. Mm-hmm. And that suggests that what they are doing is different in a meaningful way, which takes us back to specialization.
Yeah.
That yes, it's important. Of course, it's important to have a highly educated workforce. But what that workforce is dedicated to doing is crucial and crucially shapes the development of the region. So it's really about the kinds of activities that an economy is engaged with that is going to powerfully shape what it does in the present, but also the kinds of pathways that it can take in a more dynamic sense.
And when you're talking about specialization, are we thinking about this in terms of specialization in terms of sectors or industries? Or are we talking about specialization in the sort of the tasks or the functions that are undertaken irrespective of the sector or the industry in which they... I mean, again, there's a whole live conversation about all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question. I mean, and it speaks to the tools that we have to describe the world around us.
Yeah.
And those tools sometimes, frankly, are a bit crude. They're not always up to the task. And so certainly sticking with just sort of basic industrial categories, especially more aggregate industrial categories, can be very, very misleading in terms of its ability to give us a handle on what an economy is actually doing. And so in our two regions, for instance, we show how as we get very, very aggregate, the two regions look very, very similar. And as we start to unpack and get deeper and deeper and deeper, you can see quite clearly in the most detailed industrial categories. So here we're talking for those who think about those things in this way, you know, six-digit industrial codes, so rather detailed, that workers in the Bay Area are earning much, much, much more than their counterparts in the same kinds of detailed industrial categories, which again suggests that they're doing different things. And so one of the things that we do in the book, and you point this out in general, that there's this sort of trend to look at tasks and work activities as a way to sort of unpack and see a bit more clearly, perhaps, or at least get a different lens into things. When we look at the kinds of task characteristics that workers in each region are doing, we see that workers in the Bay Area are much more focused on what we call non-routine kinds of activities. Mm-hmm. Things that require interpersonal complexity, things that require cognitive complexity, and so on. Whereas even within, you know, relatively narrowly defined industrial categories, workers in LA are doing more routine work. And so that shows up in wages. That tells us that even within the industries we have, two places can be ostensibly specialized in the same kind of work, but be actually doing quite different things with very powerful consequences in terms of development.
Yeah. And go on to other things, but I just wanted to... Towards the end of the book, you raise some interesting questions almost, or reflections, that is the Bay Area today too specialized? In a sense, is it, you know, if we were looking forward 40 years, would we now think actually we can see the moments when the Bay Area has, you know, is in some ways replicating the problems that we saw in the 1970s? Mm. It almost feels like it's a, you know, it's a reflective piece towards the end of the book, and that warrants a whole, you know, further range of investigation and exploration. But just a thought on that, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a question behind the question, or a sort of a topic behind the topic, which is about, you know, will the Bay Area be the center of high-tech activity, the sort of the cutting edge economically forever, right? Which people ask all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether it's a matter of being too specialized, in the sense that, you know, one way to think about the Silicon Valley economy these days, and it's probably the way that Silicon Valley likes to see itself, as being not so much around focused on high tech per se, but about sort of seeding and generating new economically important ideas.
Yeah.
And that's a very sort of powerful notion, and it's one that seems very appealing, and one that sort of proposes that the Bay Area can hang on forever, that will, you know, it will sort of, it has figured out through its organizational innovation, you know, venture capital and all of the sort of ecology of things happening in the Bay Area, how to stay at the leading edge in perpetuity. But it's an idea that I don't really believe, and it's one that isn't very strongly supported by history.
Right.
In the sense that there have been, you know, in the moment, again, sort of coming back to that shoulder in 1970, there were places that seem like they are at the top, and that their position on the top seems really written in stone, and it's going to be cemented. And yet, what I think that sort of perspective undervalues is the shock of this radically new sort of economy emerging. And nobody knows when that new economy, that the new economy will emerge.
And one of the stories, again, it's a small piece in the book, which I found fascinating, was I think is it Motorola? I think it's Motorola.
Yeah.
And how they acquire or innovate, but actually then the way that they organize themselves structurally actually then prevents any multiplier or kind of spillover effects from that innovation. But just a fascinating insight around organizational structure, organizational culture, institutional culture, and how important that is to allow spillovers and networks to emerge.
Absolutely. I think, based on many, many decades of research from a wealth of researchers, we have, I think, a pretty good sense of the sort of pattern when there are major shocks in the economy in terms of how this plays out in space. And generally, the way it plays out in space is that there are people tinkering in all sorts of different places. There is some sort of big innovation that comes along with sort of actors who are able to bring people together that pulls one place ahead. That place then is subject to increasing returns to scale, meaning that there are sort of benefits to getting bigger that are self-reinforcing. Yeah. And a place emerges as a kind of a winner. And that's what happened to Silicon Valley. That's what didn't happen to Motorola in Phoenix, which sort of moves too early and is kind of isolated and doesn't manage to build an ecosystem. I mean, interestingly, in biotechnology, that's also what happens in Los Angeles with the rise of Amgen, which is the largest biotechnology company in the world, I think, and an incredibly innovative one, but one that is really completely cut off with its surroundings, in contrast to the sort of entrepreneurial ecosystem that emerges around biotechnology in the Bay Area. And so there are these different ways of organizing the economy in space with enormous consequences for wider development. Yeah.
How do you explain that organizational structure and outlook perspective at the regional scale? Why do we see this way of working or this way of thinking in LA, which is quite different from the Bay Area? And are they susceptible to change? And in a sense, can we imagine how LA goes from a closed, isolated, disconnected to having more of the attributes that the Bay Area has? I mean,
that's a great question. So yes, it can change.
Right.
And absolutely it can change. And it did change, and it changed in LA.
Yeah.
LA at the turn of the 20th century, in the first, let's say, 30 years of the 20th century, was an enormously entrepreneurial place. The rise of the movie industry there is a perfect example. The rise of the aerospace industry is another example, where you have all of the features that we describe in these sort of early days of propulsive important industries, in the sense that you have a great deal of entrepreneurial spirit, you have experimentation, you have this emergence of a kind of what we today might call a cluster around a particular set of activities, and you have positive economic development spillovers that rise from that. In LA, it changes, but it changes in the wrong direction, right? LA had that sort of entrepreneurial stuff, but they get drawn into this large-scale servicing of the Department of Defense in a culture of secrecy, meaning, right, we don't have networks of knowledge. No. We don't want to say anything to anybody else because we don't know what security clearance they have.
Yeah.
And we're producing things at mass scale, high sophistication things, but not there isn't that sort of experimentation and looseness that we have in the early days of Los Angeles. Interestingly, although you could say that... So, in terms of early days of semiconductors, the Bay Area is also producing mostly for Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. And some of that is scale and some of it is a bit more bespoke and a little bit more experimental. But there's a moment in the early 1960s where Robert McNamara, who's then the Secretary of Defense, says, we're going to spend less on this stuff. And so this is a big crisis in California, both north and south. But the firms in the Bay Area, Fairchild Semiconductor, chief among them, says, whoa, wait a minute, we need to diversify our customer base. We need to figure out how to make our products applicable outside of the Department of Defense because we're very vulnerable. And that never really happens in LA, to its great detriment in the early 1990s, when there's a very powerful shift away from spending on those sorts of activities in California. And so, in short, these sorts of cultural attributes are hugely important, but they are malleable. They can change. I'm not sure that I don't have a lever, a button I can push to make them change. But historically, we can look back and say these are not written in stone.
No, and I think one of the great ways, novel ways in some respect, you try to get at some of this is to look at the degree to which firms and or individuals are networked. And one of the ways I think you look for individuals that are sitting on more than one board of a different institution, whether it's two companies or philanthropic or civic or whatever it might be, to try and understand. And you see quite radically different degrees of interlocking and interconnection. The Bay Area being much more integrated, you know, much more having people much more in common with lots of different things. But the, Los Angeles being much, as you, I think you used the word balkanized, much more fragmented.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a fantastic insight into that. Must have been a methodological challenge.
Well, so I have to give credit to Naji Makarem, who spearheaded that part, all of that network work, which was fantastic work and really really interesting. And what it shows, as you correctly describe, is that especially towards the present, you see how these sort of the interconnections among the largest players in these two regional economies, that these interconnections are really profoundly different from each other. In a way that fits the common sorts of descriptions, in the sense that in the Bay Area, they're all locked in and connected. And sort of the ability to imagine that you, in your position in the network, might speak to somebody over there, there's always going to be a pathway with relatively few degrees of separation. That allow you to communicate with other people. Whereas in LA, they're really fragmented. I wish that we could have been able to draw those pictures in 1970, because the data doesn't really exist for that. And so we started, I think 1985 was the first year that we could do that. But even then, they looked a lot more similar in 1985 than they do in 2010 or whatever the last date is.
You've alluded to it on in the way that you've talked about the two places, but say a little bit more around the role of policy. And I think you again, what, you know, in the book brilliantly divide between intentional sort of what loosely defined economic development type strategies or investments are, and then the broader policy environment about, you know, the conditions that we find in different places. But just say something about, you know, how policy was involved in the evolution of these two places, you know, the degree of some of the choices it was trying to make or not. But, you know, how instrumental, how important was policy in that, for good, I think, or for bad, or for less good at least?
I mean, my reading of the evidence that we produced in the book is that mostly we find that policy did not have a very significant impact on things. And that's not to say that policy can't have an impact, but certainly policy at the local scale was not a huge player. And it wasn't for lack of trying to find evidence to show that places really, the things that places did made a difference. Mostly what we found, and we dedicated a considerable amount of effort to trying to chase down and understand what localities did when they did things that they called economic development.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of our realizations is that a lot of localities in California call everything that they do economic development.
Certainly the same is true in the UK.
My sense is that this is not an unusual situation.
No.
And you know, there's a logic for saying, well, look at all this economic development stuff that we're doing.
Yeah.
But most of the things that localities can do are not really sufficient to move the needle in terms of economic development.
Right.
And that's mostly because, I mean, that's not to say there's nothing that places can do. There are, of course, are important things that places can do in terms of making sure that there's sufficient housing, in terms of making sure that transportation is functional and gets people where they want to go in reasonable amounts of time. And other kinds of things too, but much of what happens in terms of what we might think of as, you know, attracting a particular kind of industry or attracting the right kinds of people. Well, mostly this is, at best, it's beggar thy neighbor. You're only going to succeed at the expense of the locality next door, or, you know, wherever the other place is. It's not really generating something new from nothing. And so I think, you know, that leads us to be relatively skeptical about what, you know, subnational governments can do to produce economic development in a meaningful sense, meaning, you know, shifting the levels of per capita income and overall economic well-being of the populace.
And that's certainly, but you do say something in the book around, you know, thinking about whether you're trying to support labor supply or workforce development versus labor demand, you know, trying to improve the innovative capacity, the competitive capacity, I suppose, of firms. And you do seem to suggest that one of those is slightly better than others, or you know, in a sense, or am I misreading that?
Well, I mean, so I think in terms of labor supply, that's out of the hands of municipalities, right? Yeah. That's a government, that's a national level kind of endeavor in which the government has provisions to create a well-educated populace, and those people sort in space to particular locations. Yeah. And it doesn't make sense for localities to particularly to get involved in that. You know, in terms of stimulating particular kinds of, let's say, cluster policies and things like that, I mean, in principle, it's not a bad idea. But I do think, and we do talk about this in the book, that there were some very high standards for thinking about cluster policy as truly generating independent benefits in the sense that, you know, are these policies really producing value that wouldn't happen ordinarily in the market?
Absolutely.
And, I mean, we do have studies that tell us that most of the time that's not really, most cluster policies don't fulfill that criterion. There are endeavors in the US and also in the UK and in Europe that are, I think, in my reading at least, pretty sophisticated about knowing about sort of the state of the literature around designing cluster policies. And so maybe this is something that will improve in the future, but I do think it's quite a high bar. And I think at times, at least, when you talk to firms in these clusters, it's not clear that they think that, you know, without some help from the government, they wouldn't be doing some of these things themselves.
Very good. As we begin to think about close, Tom, obviously we've talked about, the book talks about San Francisco and the Bay Area more generally, and obviously LA. And I mean, as you said at the start, you know, the Bay Area is probably one of, if not the most productive city regions, or, you know, regions in the globe, on the globe, never mind anywhere else. And whilst LA has done relatively worse over that period, it's still in what you term a very, very high income development club. What's your thinking around the analysis that you've done, the understanding that you now generate through the work? How does that play for, I don't know, for Detroit in the US, or, you know, for Hull or for Liverpool in the UK? Those, you know, all of those, you know, big former manufacturing, obviously Liverpool and Hull, former port towns or port cities like LA, Detroit, huge in the automobile industry. And, you know, we know all the trials and tribulations there. What does the sort of analysis and some of your policy thinking or reflecting, what does it say to those sorts of places? Where are they in, you know, in the development club, and what's open to them in terms of their possibility to change trajectory or to do better in the future than they're currently doing?
So I like that you use the word development clubs, which is something that we talk about in the book. But I think it's a central idea that gets to the heart of what you're saying. And so one of the problems with LA, and I think it's a problem that some of the other places that you mention also share, is a confusion about which club they're in.
Yes.
And so in LA's case, as in the case of Hull or Liverpool, these are in the, and to think about which club you're in, you need to think not just about your country, but about the global economy. We are in a deeply integrated global economy, Brexit notwithstanding, and the fortunes of a region depend on this broader global economy. And so thinking about which club you're in demands thinking about not just relating Liverpool to London, but relating Liverpool to, you know, Bangalore or, you know, somewhere in Vietnam, right? Yeah. And so in the case of LA, I think there was real confusion around the fact that it is in the high, sort of, it needs to be thinking of itself as figuring out how to succeed in the high road. Because LA's problem, and it's the problem of some of these other regions as well, is that it is a high-cost location in the global context. And so it needs to be able to produce industries that can generate sufficient rewards to manage those costs. It's not going to compete on the basis of manufacturing, or at least the vast majority of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. There might be some high-end manufacturing, but how many jobs that kind of manufacturing produces, it's an open question, right? A lot of it is going to be robotics and computers rather than individual workers. Mm. And so looking backwards and thinking we're going to be able to compete in the global economy on that basis, that just doesn't work. That doesn't make sense. No. So there need to be strategies that are sensitive to where one is in this sort of this club of development, and thinking about strategies in as much as policy can do anything, it has to be clear-eyed about what's on the table and what's off.
Brilliant. I want to finish with getting your perspective now more as a you know, an academic researcher on urban economies as much as the policy question. You talk a little bit towards the end about, you talked a little bit during the podcast around some of the frustrations about how we think about, I mean, where is our thinking and where is our theory on urban economic change? You know, you identify some of the weaknesses of urban economics and new economic geography and these other approaches, and we can bring them together and try to, you know, knit them together to make, but where's the field of understanding urban economic change, and what are we missing?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a tough one to answer. I mean, I think, and it's probably obvious from the book that we've written, that you know, we are certainly drawn to approaches that are not too narrowly doctrinaire. And the reason for that is simply that I think each of these kinds of approaches has some ideas to add to the pot, but being too sort of narrowly focused really limits our attention to the complexities of this subject. Mm. So if we're really interested in economic development, and we want, which, you know, many of us come to this subject because we want places that are struggling to do better, and we want places that are doing better to continue to do well. And trying to understand that problem demands that we are rather interdisciplinary. Yeah. So I think it behooves all of us to think beyond these sort of narrow camps and to talk more to each other to try and understand what each other is saying. I don't think that's sort of a magic bullet that's going to allow us to create development wherever we want. But I do think it's sort of a necessary precondition to trying to understand this subject.
Brilliant. My guest today has been Tom Kemeny. Tom, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. City Talks is edited by Ilya Popovsky. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.